Hi, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. And it is April 22nd. We're going to finish up the chapter on blood and the introduction to cardiovascular system. But I'm interested in hearing any questions that you might have.
I don't have a question about that.
Oh, you don't? Maybe see me right after class.
Okay.
Right after. But other than that, yes, you have my permission. You weren't asking for permission. Okay. Okay, some people were asking, where can you find the recordings of the lectures? Like I'm recording this right now. All right, so I just signed up for a site on justhost.com. You guys might, if you put a website up, that's a pretty decent site. And the URL is www.dr-j-gober.com. Or if you want to say dr-j-gober.com, that's fine. Okay, that will take you right there. And, of course, you'll have to mouse around in the left-hand frame to get to 241 and then to the particular lecture that you want. All those lectures are there except for the ones this week, but I'll do that over the weekend. All right? Okay, so that might be handy. I haven't checked it out. I'm sure it works pretty well with Internet Explorer and Firefox, but I don't know about other browsers. So check it out, and if it's a problem, let me know, and I'll thank you for that. I'm not sure I could fix it, but thanks anyway. Okay, so we were talking about some properties of the heart last time, and especially the electrophysiology. So if you think in terms of electrophysiology and a graph, right, so marry the concept of a graph and electrophysiology of the heart together. What were we looking at last time in terms of electrophysiology and graphs of something that had to do with the electrophysiology? I hear some thoughts rambling around, but I'm not sure I hear anything. Okay, think in terms of electrophysiology of the heart. And we were looking at a graph. We were looking at some graphs of the heart relating electrophysiology. And I was just wondering, what were those things that we were looking at in that graph? Cardiac cycle. Not really the whole, well, you know, we did look at the whole cardiac cycle. All right, we looked at pressure, right, in the ventricles. But is that electrophysiology? No, that's just some mechanical events of the heart. We looked at volume changes in the heart over the cardiac cycle. But is that electrophysiology? No. That's just mechanical things. All right, but what was something else? All right, the electrophysiology is the action potentials. Right, the sodium going in, potassium coming out, calcium. Don't forget calcium is very important in the heart. All right, so did I tell you what I was thinking? Already I forgot. What were those graphs of? Action potentials. Yeah, I think I did tell you. Action potentials. And how many different kinds of action potentials did we see? How many different kinds? Oh, you almost said it, but you're not sure. Two different kinds of action potentials, right? Two different kinds. There's one that had this plateau phase and this other that did not have a plateau phase. So the electrophysiology of the heart can be broken down into two different domains, one produced by one type of cell and another action potential produced by another class of cells. And that's what I was actually trying to get at. What are the two classes of cells in the heart that we looked at last time in terms of electrophysiology? Two kinds of cells. They were the nodal cells and the contractile cells. That's what I wanted you to get straight in your mind. The nodal cells and contractile cells, those are both myocytes. They're both muscle cells, cardiac muscle cells. The one group is specialized to contract and the other is not really specialized to contract. The nodal cells are there to control the contraction of the heart but not necessarily produce tension or force. But the contractile cells are really there to generate force and pressure to pump blood. Okay, so try to think of the heart along those two different cell lines, the nodal versus the contractile cells. And besides that, inside the heart, I want to just touch this before I continue with lecture a little bit. There's another kind of tissue in the heart that is not made up of myocardial contractile cells or nodal cells. It's mostly connective tissue. And in anatomy, did you learn any of the special kinds of connective tissues that are in the heart and where they are located? Remember the fibrous skeleton? And I got a picture on the screen of the fibrous skeleton. Where do you find the fibrous skeleton? Or the fibrous myocardium? And some of the important functions of the fibrous myocardium. Because it's going to relate to electrophysiology, but kind of in an anti-sense. The fibrous myocardium is between the atria and the ventricles. There's like a cap of connective tissue that separates the atria from the ventricles. As a matter of fact, this is a nice way of thinking of breaking the heart into two components. You can break it into two components by thinking, what, right side versus left side, systemic versus pulmonary circulation, but you could also think in terms of atria versus ventricles, and what separates the two is the fibrous myocardium, or the fibrous skeleton. So it's connective tissue. And here you see it right here. Right? It acts as a base or an attachment point for the muscles of the atria on the superior margin, and on the inferior margin, which we can't see if you flip this over, it acts as an attachment point for the ventricle, the muscle cells of the ventricle that contract. And the other thing that it does, there is a fibrous circle, what we call the annulus fibrosi, which all of these valves are attached to. All right, so the valves are attached to the fibrous skeleton as well, so that the valves don't move around when the heart contracts. And when the heart contracts, it's a fairly violent kind of movement when it contracts. So these valves have to be held in place really, really tightly. The other good thing is if you ever need a valve replacement, guess what? You have a nice place to sew a replacement valve into. The fibrous myocardium is really strong and can hold sutures very, very nicely. Okay. Now, connective tissue does not have any sodium channels, doesn't have any calcium channels, doesn't have potassium channels. So in terms of electrophysiology, what can you tell me about the fibrous myocardium? It's pretty inert. It cannot conduct action potentials or any kind of electrical information. All right, so we're going to see how important that is in just a little bit. So where the heck did we leave off last time? Someplace, maybe around here somewhere. Okay, we talked about the plateau phase. All right, so we got a couple action potentials that we're looking at. I'm going back. So here's a train of action potentials. And by looking at this, where do we find these action potentials? What kind of tissues are producing these action potentials right here? Nodal cells. Okay, and of course it says it on the slide, but in nodal cells, I think the important thing to remember is that these depolarizations are spontaneous and the heart is autorhythmic because of this region right here. There is no stable resting membrane potential. This area right here, which normally would be RMP, you notice is always drifting up toward threshold because of these HCN channels that leak sodium into the cells, which then slowly depolarize each of these cells in the pacemaker, and then an action potential starts. And then an action potential will spread through the whole myocardium, because what kind of synapses between the myocardial cells of the heart? The cells of the heart are connected by electrical synapses, and a good example of what makes an electrical synapse is a gap junction, right, in the intercalated discs. Okay, so these nodal cells spontaneously depolarize. And that characteristic can be attributed partly to all cells of the myocardium, but especially the nodal cells. The contractile cells, on the other hand, produce an action potential that looks like this, which has a plateau region, which is produced by what kind of membrane channel? These cells have a special membrane channel that neurons don't have. The voltage-gated calcium channels. And these are slow. right? So calcium leaks into the cell, and can you see that that causes or sustains depolarization, right? Because calcium is a cation. All right, and so, but what is the bottom line? What's the perfect reason to have this plateau region here in contractile cells of the myocardium? It prevents the heart from doing something. Yeah, it prevents the heart from going into tetanus, right? And that's like the last thing in the world you would want your heart to do. All right, so I want you to understand how tetanus relates to ion channels, and specifically certain ions as well, namely calcium. Okay. All right, I don't think we talked about the conduction system. I think we stopped at this slide last time, so maybe we can go over some of the conducting systems of the heart. All right, the SA node, which has the steepest slope of depolarization during that resting phase, so this acts as the normal pacemaker of the heart. And when it depolarizes and an action potential ensues, that action potential will flow throughout the whole, or through both atria, okay, because of gap junctions between the contractile cells. And so since both of these atria are connected together electrically, we call that a syncytium. So it only takes one action potential to cause both atria to depolarize. And then what follows after depolarization? There's repolarization, okay? And what kind of mechanical event follows that action potential, depolarization and repolarization? What happens after that? Then you have contraction, right? You have contraction of the atria through excitation, contraction, coupling kinds of mechanisms, which maybe I have to say a couple words about. All right, so the atria are signaled to contract because of that action potential, right? And that action potential is going to flow down here to this to the atrial ventricular junction right here. Now, what about the action potentials? Can these action potentials move across the fibrous skeleton? They cannot, right? Because the ventricles are electrically isolated from them because of that connective tissue. All right, so there has to be a special way, a special pathway for electrical signals to move into the ventricles, and here's the special nodal cells. All right, the atrioventricular node depolarizes, but it takes a while for it to depolarize. This acts as a delay line. It captures the electrical signal, but it doesn't transmit it directly to the ventricles. It holds on to it for a second, and then the action potential moves through the atrioventricular bundle. So this is one, kind of sophisticated, but it's simple because it's just one little pathway through the fibrous skeleton, right, to allow action potentials into the ventricle. So you could actually maybe think of this as like a little spark in your engine, in your car, that starts the reaction. All right, so then action potential hits the bundle of His, or the AV bundle right here, and now it travels very rapidly down the right and left bundle branches, and it gets down to, what part of the heart is this down here? This is the apex of the heart. The action potentials reach the apex of the heart very quickly, right? But still, the atria have contracted first, right? They've still contracted first, and as the action potentials reach the apex of the heart, then the action potentials are transferred to these tiny little fibers here, which we call Purkinje fibers, which then spread a wave of depolarization throughout the ventricles, starting with the apex of the heart, right? Followed by what, the more superior regions of the free wall of the ventricles and even of the septum right here. Right, it's only through these Purkinje fibers that an action potential can pass to the contractile cells of the myocardium. So we see that the heart contracts in a very specific way, right? Our very early understanding is that I said the heart contracts as a unit because of electrical synapses. But now I think you have to appreciate that the heart doesn't just contract as a single unit, but in a couple of different ways. There's a certain part of the heart that contracts first. And what is that? The atria, okay? And then at a later time, because of the delay of this AV node right here, then the ventricles contract. Now, why does that make good sense for the heart to do that? Because what's the job of the atria? To pump blood into the ventricles, right? So that should happen before the ventricles start pumping blood, right? If they start pumping blood at the same time, then because these atria are so weak, they'd never be able to pump any blood into the ventricles. So first the atria contract, that helps load up the ventricles with blood, and then the ventricles contract, pumping blood into the arteries right here. What are the two arteries? Pulmonary and aorta, right? Okay. All right. And even more than that, something else that's more important, what were to happen if more of the basal regions of the ventricle were to contract before the apical regions of the heart? What would happen? Which way would blood flow? If the basal regions contracted before the apical regions, then blood would be forced down into the apex and have no place to go. Right, so what's really nice about the conduction system is that the apex contracts first and it forces blood up into the great arteries at the base of the heart. Right, and it should contract just like that. So that's the function of the conduction system right here. So it not only controls the rate of contraction, but how the heart contracts to pump blood efficiently. Okay, so this is basically everything I said so far. All right, let's compare excitation-contraction coupling of the myocardial cells with skeletal muscle. We're going to do this a couple times in these two chapters. All right, depolarization of myocardial cell opens voltage-gated calcium channels, right, in the sarcolemma. And this depolarization opens voltage-gated as well as calcium release channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so there are two kinds of mechanisms right here, the voltage-gated calcium channels and the calcium-induced calcium release channels, right? And then, so now we have this big flood of calcium from sarcoplasmic reticulum into the cytosol of these myocytes, and then, of course, just like in skeletal muscle, calcium binds to troponin, and that stimulates contraction just like it does in skeletal muscle because that moves tropomyosin out of the way, revealing the myosin binding sites on actin, so cross-bridge cycling can take place. And all the while, calcium is being pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum by these ATP pumps, and that's going to cause relaxation of cardiac muscle. Now, there is one particular membrane channel or receptor that is found in skeletal muscle but not found in cardiac muscle, and that's the ryanodine receptor. I don't think I have a picture of it. There's a pretty good picture in your book. I should actually put that in a slide. All right, so in skeletal muscle, you have the ryanodine receptor that couples the voltage-gated channel on the T-tubule to the calcium release channel on the sarcoplasmic reticulum. It's just a mechanical coupling kind of receptor that's absent in cardiac muscle. But nonetheless, both have the calcium-induced calcium release channels. Okay. All right, so let's just kind of conclude our understanding of this action potential right here that we see on this slide. What kind of cell produces this action potential? Okay, and this graph is missing something. I see one axis here, millivolts, right? So we're measuring electricity versus time. But I see two graphs. I see one in green and I see one in red. How'd I do? Pretty good? Okay. The green represents millivolts, right? This red right here is actually a measure of force or tension, which is a lot different than voltage, right? So there should really be another axis over here telling us how much tension this muscle is producing, right? So these are two opposite kinds of measurements. All right, so what does the green line represent? What does it represent? Well, it's labeled, it's an action potential, but now here's a really good question. Action potential from where? What kind of cell? Contractile cell because of this plateau phase. All right, so here is just the superposition of the action potential with the tension that's produced by this particular cell versus time. And you can see that because of the absolute refractory period, and that's due to inactivation gates on sodium channels, right? And the hyperpolarization that occurs right here, right, that this cell cannot produce another contraction until this first contraction almost completely dies away. All right, so this just reinforces the concept of how this refractory period prevents tetanus from developing in cardiac muscle. Okay, so I think the other thing that's important to look at this slide is that there is a difference between the electrical events of the heart and the mechanical events of the heart, and which you can see that they're kind of correlated, right? But which one comes first? Electrical, and as a matter of fact, this electrical event does cause contraction. All right, so there is cause and effect here, not just correlation. Okay. Well, we can use, because every cell that's contracting in the heart produces an action potential that looks like this, right? And if we add up all of this electrical activity from all the cells inside the heart, we can actually measure the electrical activity of the heart on the surface of our body. And that's called the electrocardiogram. Now, who knows how many cells does the heart have? 2, 3, something like that. The reason, and the answer is nobody really knows yet. I don't think anybody really measured how many cells. There might be millions or there might even be a billion. I'm not really sure how many are there. So if we add together all of the electrical events, namely all of these action potentials, all the millions of action potentials together, right, it's not too far to imagine that you could measure that electrical activity on the surface of your body, because the heart is so big, it produces a big voltage change. So if we put electrodes on somebody's body, and you did this in lab, I don't think I have a diagram right here, but you need 3 electrodes to get a good electrocardiogram, right, maybe on 2 wrists and an ankle, or an ankle and a wrist, and then a second wrist. We're going to measure the electrical activity between 2 points, and then we got to have a ground just to stabilize the system. And when we do that, we get an electrical event that looks like this, and it has a number of what we call waves associated with it. The first one is what we call the P wave. Why do we call it the P wave? I could never find out. No one could ever tell me. But I have an idea. What does primavera mean? Primary. First one is my guess, is how it kind of happened. All right, so P wave is the first one. And the QRS complex is the second one, and then the T wave right here is the third one. So you have to know what these different waves represent. So in terms of anatomy, what chambers contract first? Both atria, right, then both ventricles. And the atria have to depolarize, so the P wave right here represents atrial depolarization. And then we see a little delay right here between the P and the Q wave. This represents the delay of the action potentials going through the, what part of the conduction system? The AV node that holds onto the signal, and then it passes through the bundle of His down through the Purkinje fibers, causing depolarization over the whole heart, and that produces the rest of the QRS complex. Okay, so QRS is due to this depolarization of the myocardium, but it also represents something else too that we can't really separate out, and that is repolarization of the atria. That happens during this time as well. But as you can imagine, which tissue has many more cells, both ventricles or both atria? Both ventricles are huge compared to the atria. So primarily this signal right here comes from the ventricles, and it completely overwrites the signals that we could possibly see from the atria. Kind of an analogy to that is if you were to go outside right now, maybe it's a little cloudy, but let's pretend it's not cloudy and you look up at the sky. Do you see any stars up there in the sky? You would only see one, which is the sun, right? But are there stars up in the sky? There are. Why can't you see them? Because the sun is too bright. You just don't have the right dynamic range in our eyes to see a bright light like the sun and very dim light like those stars that are out there. So the same reason here for the QRS complex, we can only see ventricular depolarization and not atrial repolarization. All right. And then at another time, here's the T wave, which represents what? Ventricular repolarization. So we have a nice justification of this action potential from a contractile cell superimposed with the QRS complex to see how they relate to each other. Okay, so please remember these three distinct waves and what they're produced by. All right, so remember, the ECG waveforms are not a measure of contraction. They are strictly what kind of events? Electrical events, right? So they're due to the electrophysiology. So it precedes contraction. It's a signal for contraction. And what kind of machine did you use to record an ECG in lab? It's an electrocardio. Now, this is way before your time, but there was a time when people communicated, right, with like little dots and dashes and stuff, and they would send these signals over wires. And, okay, I guess it was Morse code. They used Morse code. But there was a machine that could send a telegram. And what was the name of the machine? A telegraph, right? So the machine that measures an ECG is what? Electrocardiograph is a machine that makes an electrocardiogram. All right, so you might want to be just a little familiar with that terminology, though it's a little archaic. But we still take electrocardiograms of people all the time, so that's not going to ever go away. Okay. Which events occur first in the heart? The mechanical events, which is contraction, or the electrical events? The electrical events. All right, so here we just see pretty much what I described already. And a little bit of motion. It's probably really nicely color-coded for you right here. And we can see the SA node depolarizes, which then causes depolarization of the atria, and you can see the beginning of the P wave, right? And that depolarization flows over both atria, right? So that completes the P wave right here. But notice, depolarization of the atria does not immediately stimulate depolarization in the ventricles. What's the structure that's preventing that from happening? What's the structure that prevents depolarization or action potentials from moving from the atria into the ventricles? Fibrous myocardium, right? All right, but then the myocardium does start to depolarize, right? Because that goes through what, the AV node, right? Then the AV bundle, down the bundle branches, and then through the Purkinje fibers, starting down at the apex of the heart, which then is going to signal contraction of these apical fibers right here, and then it's going to move up the free walls and even the septum of the heart, then causing contraction of the more basilar regions of the heart. So you can see that as the QRS, and then repolarization is due to that T wave. Okay. We talked about heart sounds already. I'm not so interested in this figure because the one I gave you last time is much better. But we could go over it really fast. All right, here we see a little, we're going to look at, I guess I'll go over this diagram fairly fast. We have pressure versus time on this first graph, and then we have what versus time down over here. What versus time? What are we looking at? Electrocardiogram. What is that? A measure of voltage versus time. And then here we have some other squiggly lines. What is this? These are heart sounds, right? So this is just noise coming from your body versus time, or sounds. Okay. So here I see a little bump. And here I see a really big bump in pressure. This represents the pressure inside the ventricle. So let's just say left ventricle. So here I see this tiny little bump right here. What does that do to? Why does pressure in the ventricles increase a little bit even before the QRS complex? Okay, here is depolarization of the atria. And notice, just after that, we have contraction of the atria pumping blood into the ventricles. And when atria pump blood into the ventricles, you get this little transient increase in pressure. Pretty minuscule. So you can see that the function of the atria, at least in humans, is not all that important. Clinically, we're really not concerned whether we see this little bump here or not. Right? So the atria and us are hardly doing anything. But they can cause pathology. If they don't contract, if the atria don't contract, what happens to the blood that are in the atria? It has a tendency to stay there. And what happens to blood when it stops flowing? It coagulates. All right, and if you have coagulation in the heart, is that like no problem or a little problem or a big problem? That's a huge problem, okay? So if you have atrial fibrillation or other kinds of electrophysiology abnormalities in the atria that don't contract properly, then the heart will generate blood clots. All right, so that has to be dealt with. All right, not because of this little bump right here, but that's where that little bump comes from. And then you get the QRS complex, and what happens? Well, then the ventricles start to contract. And the pressure inside the ventricles exceed the pressure in the atria because they're contracting. Blood is going to want to go from, how does blood flow in terms of pressure, from where to where? High pressure to low, so it's going to be high in the ventricles, low in the atria because they're already, what, relaxing at this point in time. All right, so blood is going to want to go from ventricle to atria, but should it? No, what's the structure that prevents that? On the left side of the heart. That would be the bicuspid valve. It closes, and when it closes, it makes this sound right here. Oh, it even tells you right there. Erase it from your notes and make sure that you can write it in. AV valve close. All right? And then, okay, as blood is ejected from the heart, the pressure goes down in the ventricles, even though maybe they're still contracting a little bit. The pressure goes down below the pressure in the aorta. So blood in the aorta, when it squirts back into the ventricles, but what prevents blood in the aorta from moving back into the left ventricle? The aortic semilunar valve, so it closes, and when it snaps closed, it produces the second heart sound, right? So first heart sound, AV valves close. Second heart sound, the semilunar valves close. All right, so that you should be really familiar with that. Structure of blood vessels. I got to say a couple things about blood vessels. All right, well, let's look at some of these questions. Material can enter or leave the blood only through what kind of structure?
Capillaries.
Only through capillaries, right? So capillaries are specialized for, what's the key term?
Exchange.
Okay, and that's, I might have a question here, but why is that true? Because capillaries are thin. Arteries, all veins, no matter if they're a venule or a vein, the walls are way too thick to allow for exchange. All right, what structure regulates blood flow through a capillary? We're going to look at that in just a little bit. It's called the precapillary sphincter. What the heck is a sphincter? What's an orbicularis? Where do you have an orbicularis? Yeah, around your eye. All right, and orbicularis is a circular skeletal muscle that, of course, you have voluntary control over, but a sphincter is a circular smooth muscle. You don't have voluntary control over those, right? Those are controlled through your autonomic nervous system or through autoregulation or through local control, which I'll describe in just a little bit. All right, so what structure regulates blood flow through a capillary? Yeah, the precapillary sphincter. Name two mechanisms which help return blood to the heart. I'm going to have to talk about that. Yeah, blood returns to the heart through what kind of blood vessel? A vein. All right, and I'll come back to that one. This is just reminding me, I guess, what to talk about. Name three types of cardiovascular structures that have valves. We'll talk about that. Which layer is responsible for forming valves? All right, I got to talk about that. What is the difference between a sphincter and a valve? A sphincter is made out of what kind of tissue? Smooth muscle, right? So is that active or passive when a muscle contracts? It's active. And you know it's active because what molecule is required? ATP, right? You need an energy molecule, namely ATP, for muscles to contract. Valves, on the other hand, do not need ATP. They're passive. They just open or close depending on pressure gradients. All right, so I don't want to review things about arteries and veins necessarily in here because that's just anatomy. But here is something I do want you to know. All right, so here you have an artery, and in the systemic circulation, that's going to have oxygen and nutrients. And then here is a little arteriole, and then here is a capillary bed, capillary network. And adjusting the flow through this capillary network is this precapillary sphincter, which is circular smooth muscle. And when this precapillary sphincter contracts, what happens to blood flow through this capillary? It decreases. And when this precapillary sphincter dilates, what happens to blood flow through a capillary? it goes way up, right? So vasoconstriction or vasodilation at the precapillary sphincter adjusts blood flow through this capillary bed. Now, the tissues that are supplied by this capillary bed, of course, are living tissues. They need oxygen and nutrients, but when do they need more oxygen and nutrients compared to when they don't? When they are doing what? Let's just say it's a muscle. It's a nice skeletal muscle, biceps muscle. When they're contracting, right? When a muscle is contracting, you should have a pretty good feel for that. And why is that so when a muscle is contracting? Because what is that muscle using up? It's using up ATP. And how do you make a lot of ATP in your body? What's that process? Two words. Oh, that's not bad. Yeah, aerobic respiration. I was thinking of oxidative phosphorylation, but yeah, we're on the same track, okay? Oxidative phosphorylation. So, right, this tissue needs oxygen, needs glucose to make ATP. So would you want to decrease blood flow to this area when the muscle's exercising, or increase blood flow? You should increase blood flow, so, right, to deliver oxygen and nutrients to that particular muscle. All right, so when oxygen concentration decreases, or maybe when CO2 concentration does what? When the muscle's exercising, what happens to CO2? It increases. That's a waste product of cellular respiration. Or maybe a breakdown product of ATP. Guess what a breakdown product of ATP is? Like ADP, maybe even AMP or adenosine. When adenosine concentrations increase, all right? When a muscle is contracting, potassium is leaving the cell. So as potassium increases, as CO2 increases, as adenosine increases, these are all chemicals that we think cause relaxation of the precapillary sphincter. And when the precapillary sphincter relaxes, what happens to blood flow? It comes in, washes away the adenosine, washes away the carbon dioxide, brings in oxygen. All right, so what kind of feedback mechanism is that? That's a nice negative feedback mechanism that maintains the proper levels of oxygen to those cells so that they can continue to do what? Function properly, namely contract. So the regulation of this precapillary sphincter is what we say is under local control. Local control just means that the metabolism of the tissues in this capillary bed sends signals to the precapillary sphincter to adjust the amount of blood flow so that those tissues can maintain their function. All right, so I do want you to know local control. And it's just a nice, typical negative feedback mechanism. So what were some of the things that caused dilation? Maybe increases in CO2, adenosine. What else did I say? Potassium. Right? Because potassium should be inside the cell, not outside. But during repolarization, potassium leaves. If it builds up outside the cell, that can cause relaxation of that precapillary sphincter, increasing blood flow. So here are some things. How about maybe another one? Okay. Decrease in pH. Because remember, when a muscle starts to work, it's going to use up oxygen, so it's going to shift from aerobic respiration to anaerobic respiration, and when it's working via these anaerobic conditions, what molecule builds up? Well, you all know this before you took this class. And it makes your muscles sore. Lactic acid. So, if lactic acid builds up, what happens to pH? Remember, they're inversely related because of that pH equation goes down. All right, so as the muscle or this area becomes more acidic, that has a tendency to relax the precapillary sphincter, right? Bringing it back to normal pH. So that's what we call local control. Okay. Make sure you know that there's three different kinds of capillaries in your body by structure, which means if they have different structures, guess what? They have a little bit different function, right? And the structures just help regulate how leaky they are. Some capillaries are not very leaky, like these continuous. Right, some are pretty leaky, which we call fenestrated, and then there are others that are super leaky. We call those sinusoids or discontinuous capillaries. All right, veins. You know, a definition of a vein takes blood back to the heart. Veins contain most of the blood in our body. They can expand and contract, which means that they have a lot of capacity and a lot of compliance. Compliance just means that they can expand. There's very low pressure in veins, about 2 millimeters of mercury, and that may be good, may be bad. So if there's high pressure in an artery and only, say, maybe 120 millimeters of mercury in an artery and 2 millimeters in a vein, which way is blood going to flow? Into the vein, right? From high pressure to low pressure. All right, so that's good. But what about the pressure at the heart? You know, it's still going to be very close to 2 millimeters of mercury. It's maybe actually a little bit negative. It might be about 1 or 2 millimeters of mercury below atmospheric pressure, so that would be a minus sign. So there's only maybe about 2 to 4 millimeters of mercury difference in pressure between the heart and veins. That doesn't produce a lot of blood flow from veins to the heart. But is that important? Is it? Absolutely. Because if blood doesn't get into the heart, when it contracts, what's it going to pump? Not much, right? So blood has to get back to the heart somehow. How does it get back to the heart? This is one of the first questions that I asked you on that first slide. Okay, there are two important mechanisms for return of blood to the heart. Veins, so here I have an example of a vein, and how do I know this is a vein right here, not an artery? And don't tell me because it's pink or purple or what, or blue or whatever color it is. You can tell me by the structure. What does it have that an artery does not have? It has valves. So veins have valves, and probably in anatomy somebody told you or you read the layer that makes these valves right here. This answers another question on the beginning of your chapter. Right? You should become familiar with the different layers of a blood vessel, but the endothelium makes valves, which is what? The innermost layer of a blood vessel. As a matter of fact, even in the heart, what do we call the endothelium in the heart? It's the same stuff, it's the same junk, but since it's in the heart, we give it a different name. We call it the endocardium, right? So in the heart has valves, you agree? Raise your hand. A couple people, good. All right, the heart has valves. Oh, how many does it have? Very good. All right, the heart valves are made out of the endocardium, just like the valves in these veins are made out of the endothelium, right? And what is one property of endocardium or endothelium? Is it rough and jagged? Smooth and slippery. Smooth and slippery so that blood can flow over it very nicely without triggering coagulation. That's a really important function. Okay. Since there's a valve, it means that blood can flow how many directions? Only one direction, right? So if we pressurize this segment of a vein, maybe by just voluntarily contracting these muscles, standing up, moving around, right, whatever, then these muscles are going to bulge and it's going to compress this blood vessel right here, and it's going to produce a high pressure in this region, and it's going to want to squirt away from this region. Which way is it going to squirt? Is it going to squirt down or is it going to squirt up? It's going to squirt up because the valves only allow for flow in one direction. So the skeletal muscle pump is the first pump that we use to explain how we get blood back to the heart. Anytime you contract the skeletal muscle, it's going to squirt some venous blood back to the heart, as we see in this condition right here, under normal circumstances. But maybe what happens if this blood vessel right here, this vein, starts to dilate, right, and it gets bigger in diameter than the length of this valve right here. So now the valves will flop back and forth, but they'll never approximate each other to close. So what's going to happen then to somebody when their veins start to dilate? Then blood is going to be trapped in this extremity right here. We would call that, it will produce thrombosis, thrombi in the veins because blood won't be flowing back to the heart, right? And that can be superficial veins like varicose veins, or it can even be deep veins in the legs, and we would call that deep venous thrombosis, right? So those are pretty, you think those are serious conditions? Well, absolutely, because you never want blood clots floating around in your circulatory system. Okay, so that's one pump. The second pump has to do with respiration. All right, it has to do with your lungs. All right, so you know air is flowing in and out of your lungs all the time. And why does it flow in and out of your lungs? Because pressure. How does air flow? High pressure to low pressure. All right, so when air is flowing into your lungs, where is there low pressure? Inside your lungs, right? So it's high in the room, low in your lungs, so air flows into your lungs. We'll talk about this when we get to the respiratory system, but that's the basic reason why. When air flows out, where is pressure low? Outside your body. So it's high inside your lungs and low in the air, so air flows out of your lungs. Okay. So do you believe me that air flows in and out of your lungs? Absolutely. Okay. And it flows in because of low pressure inside your lungs. But it's not low pressure inside your lungs, it's low pressure that's developed everywhere in your thoracic cavity. It just so happens your lungs are in your thoracic cavity. So not only is air flowing into your lungs, during inspiration, when you expand your rib cage, when you expand your thoracic cavity, not only air is flowing in, but what else is flowing into your thoracic cavity? When the pressure inside your thoracic cavity decreases, blood from everywhere in your body flows into your thoracic cavity because of the expansion of your thorax. All right, and then when you breathe out, pressure goes up, but what happens to that blood in your thorax? Does it go back out to the extremities? No, why not? Because there's valves and veins, all right? So every time you inhale, that has a tendency to draw blood toward your heart to complete the circulation, and we call that the respiratory pump, right? So you got skeletal muscle pump and respiratory pump. Oh, that's the last slide. How sad. Okay, for this particular chapter. Ah, all right, so let's take just a little bit of time. Oh, we've got a question. Oh, the three kinds of structures that have valves. Veins, heart, and there's a system that I haven't talked about in here, but also lymphatic vessels have valves. And a best way to think of a lymphatic vessel is that, oh, and you already know, I gave you a hint. Okay. What other structure has a valve? Veins. So lymphatic vessels kind of are like veins. All right, they're very thin, they don't have a lot of musculature, and they have valves. And lymph is a fluid that you have all over your body, travels through the lymphatic system, and is delivered back to the cardiovascular system pretty much at the level of the subclavians. And the reason why lymph flows back to the subclavian is the same reason why blood flows through veins back to the heart. What were the two reasons? Two reasons why blood flows back to the heart? The two different pumps, skeletal muscle pump and the respiratory pump. So those two pumps return lymph fluid back to the subclavian veins. Okay, because actually I think lymphatic vessels have a little bit more smooth muscle and lymphatic vessels have some peristalsis associated with them, which means that it can actually move lymph in a way that can't happen for blood and veins. Okay, that's probably a minor consideration. All right, so let's take a look at, I don't know if this is the right one right here or not. That's not the right one. That's close. Where's the right one? This is it. How did I know this is the right one? Because I got a couple extra items on there for you. All right, so what are we looking at on the cardiac cycle? What are the two phases of the cardiac cycle? And you got to know their definitions. Why do you have two numbers when somebody gives you your blood pressure? What are those two numbers? Systolic and diastolic. So the two phases of the heart cycle are systole and diastole. Okay. All right, so we're going to look at pressure versus time. We're going to look at volume versus time, voltage versus time, and then sound versus time. And all of these are plotted on exactly the same time axis. So where does zero start? It starts right here. That's probably not in your lab book, so draw this little line in if you didn't download this figure yet. Okay. Where should we start? How about ECG? Does that make sense? Yeah, because electrophysiology precedes right? The tension that's developed in the heart, which would mean what? Pressure changes and volume changes of the heart. So P wave represents atrial depolarization, which is a signal for contraction right here. So if we look up at the pressure curve of the atria, which probably is J right here, so here's pressure in the atria, we see the pressure spike right here, right? Because what? The atria are going to start to contract. And as they start to contract, let's look at the pressure inside the ventricle. That produces a little increase in pressure of the ventricles because the atria start pumping blood into the atria. I mean into the ventricles, from the atria into the ventricles. All right, then what do we got? QRS complex. Does that precede contraction, or does contraction of the ventricles happen at the same time, or does it come after contraction of the ventricles? After contraction of the atria, okay, and it precedes contraction of the ventricles. So if we look at the R wave right here, we see that the ventricles really don't start contracting until way out over here someplace, okay? So we see the ventricles start to contract as a result of the QRS complex, and the ventricles are a lot stronger than the atria. So what can you tell me about the pressure of the ventricles? It increases above the atria, and right at this point, since the pressure is greater in the ventricles than the atria, which way does blood start to flow? Since it's higher pressure in the ventricles compared to the atria, where does blood flow, want to flow? From the ventricles into the atria. But can that happen in a normal heart? No, because what's there to prevent it? The AV valve is there. So the AV valve has to slam closed. And that produces this first heart sound right here, closure of the AV valves, right at this point. Okay? And then, during this point right here, the AV valve is closed, and the semilunar valve is closed. So if all the valves to the ventricle are closed, is there a way for blood to leave the ventricle? If all the doorways to this room are closed, can you get out? You can't get out. But the ventricles, nonetheless, even though all the valves are closed, the ventricles are still contracting. They're producing pressure that we see right here, right? But blood cannot be compressed. The pressure goes up, but the size of the ventricle cannot change because all the doorways are closed. So this part right here is what we call isovolumetric contraction. Right? That's an isometric contraction, which means the muscle contracts, develops more tension, but the size of the muscle, the length of these fibers, does not change. Okay. So if we look at the volume of the ventricle, even though the pressure is increasing, look at the size of the ventricle. The volume of the ventricle stays pretty much the same. It does not change. So this is what we call isovolumetric contraction. And this is about the largest volume that we can measure of the ventricle. So what do we call this volume right here? That has you got to be really familiar with that. What do we call this volume of the ventricle, which is the largest volume? That is here's maybe a better point right here. That's the end diastolic volume. Okay, so what happens during diastole? Is blood being pumped out or is blood going in? Blood is going in during diastole. So blood is flowing into the heart during diastole, and as blood is flowing in, what happens to the size of the ventricle as blood flows in? Does it shrink down? No. It gets bigger. It fills up with blood. All right, so the end diastolic volume is the largest volume of the ventricle. All right, so that's what I have labeled right here, end diastolic volume. Notice the volume doesn't change during this isovolumetric contraction. And then as pressure in the ventricle increases above that pressure in the aorta, signified by this nice dotted line right here, right, blood can flow from the ventricles into the aorta, right, because blood is always going to flow down a pressure gradient. But before blood can flow into the aorta, what has to happen right here? What normally separates the aorta from the ventricles? There's a valve, the aortic semilunar valve. Right? So right here, the aortic semilunar valve has to open, and indeed it opens. It makes a little bit of a sound, not too bad if it's a nice healthy valve. Right? And as that aortic semilunar valve opens, blood starts to flow out of the ventricle, so let's look at the volume curve. Is the volume of the ventricle going down? Yeah, so it goes down during what phase of the heart cycle? Systole, right? It's being ejected from the heart, and then the ventricles run out of blood to pump, so the pressure starts to decrease in the ventricles because all the blood is pumped out, and the pressure in the ventricles goes below the pressure in the aorta. So now blood in the aorta want to flow back into the ventricles, but should that happen? No, because if it does, eventually you're going to die. What prevents it from happening? The aortic semilunar valve at this point right here closes, right? So it closes right here. And that makes the second heart sound. Second heart sound, closure of the semilunar valves. All right, so still, so now the semilunar valve is closed. The pressure in the ventricle is higher than pressure in the atria still. So that means also that the AV valves are still closed. So what happens to the volume of the ventricles if both valves are closed? Can't change. Nothing can get in or get out. The volume stays the same. So if we look at the volume curve right here, notice that it is constant. We call this phase isovolumetric relaxation. Okay? Isovolumetric relaxation happens when the semilunar valve and AV valve is closed, and isovolumetric contraction occurs when the AV valve is closed and the semilunar valve is closed, right? That's isovolumetric. Nobody can enter or leave the ventricles. All right, and then we have the ventricles starting to fill up with blood again. Notice that the ventricles fill up with blood way before the atria contract. So most of the blood that fills up the ventricles flows right through the atria. It just passes right through in our hearts. So again, the atria are pretty insignificant in humans as long as they don't cause problems for us if they don't contract. Yeah. Oh, okay. Anytime you have an isometric period, whether it's contraction or relaxation, okay, any isovolumetric period, like isovolumetric relaxation that we see here, isovolumetric contraction here, that means that nothing can enter or leave the ventricles, so that means that all the valves have to be closed, okay? And that means what? The semilunar valve and the atrioventricular valve. Both of those have to be closed during that isovolumetric period, irrespective or regardless, I forget what the proper word is. Okay, all the valves to that ventricle have to be closed during that isovolumetric period. And it doesn't matter if it's relaxation or contraction. Okay? Okay. All right, so that goes over all the salient features of this very fine diagram right here. Okay? There's some minor little problems with it, not too bad. The only thing that I would change is at this point right here, I would probably move over to this point right here, but that's a really small, minor modification, okay? But the crossover is where the valve, all right, now what valve are we looking at right here? That's the AV valve, right? It's going to close when the pressure is higher in the ventricle compared to the atria, all right? But the crossover point is when it certainly does close. I would probably just redraw this ventricular pressure to where it crosses over right here, where you have that the line signifying isovolumetric contraction. So that's a pretty little minor mistake. All right, so look at review over the weekend, okay? The answers, and hopefully that makes a little bit of sense. And don't forget, this is an L down over here. And what is this symbol right here, where I have the cursor right now? What is that? All right, on Tuesday, you got to tell me. What are your possible choices? It could be a zero, or it could be an O. Which one is it? Okay, check it out, and it'll make sense once you see it, okay? Okay, anybody have a question on this cardiac cycle graph? Yes?
T-wave.
Okay. That is repolarization of the ventricles only.
Okay, I'm having a hard time understanding why it's going up with repolarization.
Okay, because remember, this ECG is not an action potential. This voltage that we're measuring on the surface of the body is produced by millions or even a billion action potentials deep inside your body. So there's maybe as many as a billion cells that are all repolarizing, and they're all in a little bit different phases of repolarization. And depending on what parts of the heart are repolarizing, that electrical signal is going to be a little bit different. So if you measure it between your wrist, it's going to look different between your wrist and your leg, all right, or between your back and your chest. It's going to look different depending on how you measure the voltage. So the ECG does not necessarily correspond in any intuitive way to an action potential. All right, it's just that when there's repolarization taking place, what's the best way for you to understand repolarization or hyperpolarization? What's happening during repolarization? You got potassium moving out of the cell, right? And since that's an ion, that produces electrical current. And so you got all of these millions of electrical currents adding up on the surface of your body that look like this, which really does not relate in any intuitive way to what you understand that single voltage looks like from a single cell. Okay, it just happens that if all those millions of signals adds up on the surface of your body, then it looks like that T wave, if you have the proper lead configuration. Yeah, it's just a current, it's just a superposition of all kind millions of signals. Okay, so let's say if we had one person in here reciting a poem, it would kind of sound like a poem. But let's just say we had a billion people in here all reciting that same poem, what would it sound like? Well, it would be a really big mess. You couldn't understand it. The sound would go up and go down, but I'm not sure it would relate to what you would hear if just a single person was saying it. Okay? So it's just the superposition or addition of all those electrical currents that produce that kind of voltage on the surface of the body. Okay. So that's pretty good. So let's that's the last material for the test, okay, as far as I know, and that was chapter 13. All right, so let me give you a little bit of an introduction to chapter 14. Yeah. Okay, so hopefully that will reinforce some things already. Coagulation. Okay, I can talk about it a little bit. Like, what particular question do you have? Okay, well, what's the function of coagulation? Because one of the important functions of blood, okay, is not only to just transfer heat, transfer waste products, transfer oxygen and nutrients, transfer hormones around in your body, but another really important function of blood is to actually prevent blood loss when you have damage to a blood vessel. Okay? Alright, and so what process prevents blood loss when a blood vessel is damaged? Do we call that agglutination or coagulation? That is coagulation, right? Much different than agglutination. And the bottom line for coagulation, especially let's just say that you have a macroscopic injury to a blood vessel, not just a microscopic one cell or two cell damage to a blood vessel, but a larger damage to a blood vessel, okay? How is blood stopped from flowing out of a blood vessel? What has to form? So we're going to skip the whole big process and just get to the bottom line. I like to think in terms of bottom lines a lot of times. What happens to prevent blood loss when you have major damage to a blood vessel? You've got fibrin formation. Yeah, exactly right. So somehow through this mechanism, fibrin has to be formed. And where does fibrin come from? Fibrinogen, which is a soluble protein. It goes into solution. And you have lots of fibrin in your body ready to be turned into fibrin to form a blood clot at just a second's notice, which is a good thing. So if you cut yourself, you don't have to wait around a couple weeks to build up enough fibrin in your body to close that clot, right? So the ogen represents what? What does that tell you? Fibrinogen means that it's an inactive form of fibrin. Okay. Well, I guess maybe I'll put this slide up. Let's see. Oh, wrong one. Wrong one. Where is that at? All right. Almost there. Okay. All right. So we got fibrin formation right here. Right? Fibrin formation. And what converts fibrinogen to fibrin? There's an enzyme. It is not active in your body all the time. It is thrombin. Okay, so thrombin is in your circulatory system ready to go to work, but it's not active. It has to be activated. So there's a precursor to thrombin, which we call prothrombin, right? So if you have a word with pro as a prefix or ogen as a suffix, that really means that they are inactive compounds but can be converted into an active compound very quickly to produce their action. Okay, so prothrombin gets converted to thrombin. So then we have to ask, what converts thrombin to prothrombin? And it is this activated factor 10. And sometimes we call that prothrombin activator. So prothrombin activator activates thrombin by what? By actually modifying prothrombin and converting it into thrombin. All right, and then thrombin can convert fibrinogen into fibrin, and that's going to produce a nice blood clot. All right, so that, I think, is the important step. That's what we call the common pathway. That is the important three-step process that you should be aware of in terms of this diagram. All right, so we got prothrombin activator formation, we've got thrombin formation, and then fibrin formation. So the big question is, then, this intrinsic pathway and extrinsic pathway both work by activating factor 10 right here, right? Which then becomes what? Prothrombin activator. All right, so the two ways that you can, where this happens in the body, all right, or even outside the body, we have extrinsic pathway and intrinsic pathway. Let's do the extrinsic first. This is what usually happens when you damage a blood vessel. When you damage connective tissue underlying a blood vessel, that tissue releases thromboplastin. So that is an enzyme that activates this factor 7. I don't have a question mark here. I don't even think I have a question mark by thromboplastin, but you should just realize that when you damage the tissue around a blood vessel, it's going to release this enzyme, which is going to start this extrinsic pathway. And when there's a presence of calcium in the blood, various phospholipids, as well as thromboplastin, right, this activated factor 7 then can turn on, what, can activate prothrombin activator. So that's a pretty short mechanism, right? So this thromboplastin mechanism is very fast in activating the common pathway. Nonetheless, what do I want you to know about this extrinsic pathway? What does it require in your blood? Proper levels of calcium. Without that, blood will not clot. And what would happen to you then? Well, of course, then you would bleed to death, right? Where do you get calcium from if it's low in the blood?
Bones,
exactly right, right? Okay, then we have this intrinsic pathway right here, and there are other chemical compounds that can activate these factors over here, starting with 12, right, then going to 11, then going to 9. So you might think it's a little strange that you have the big numbers going to smaller numbers, but it doesn't have to do with where the step in coagulation takes place. These numbers were just given to clotting factors as they were discovered. So factor 9 was discovered before 11, which was discovered before 12. So that's why it looks kind of out of sequence. And I'm not going to ask you to know the sequence right here. But these factors become activated, right, when platelets can be attracted, or other compounds like factor 12 right here are attracted to molecules that have a negative charge on them. Right? What kind of compounds in your body have a negative charge on them? And it's kind of the basis of the resting membrane potential and why potassium is stuck inside the cell. What draws potassium inside the cell under resting conditions? and keeps it there. You have a big reservoir of negative molecules, which are proteins. So proteins generally have a negative charge on them. And collagen is what? That's a protein that has a plethora of negative charges on it, which then can start this process right here. And where do you find collagen? Do you find it in the epithelium or endothelium of blood vessels? Not really, but it's what? In the connective tissue that's underneath the endothelium or even endocardium. So collagen isn't revealed to blood unless the blood vessel is damaged, right? And then when there's collagen in contact with blood, right, this intrinsic pathway can take place. All right, and we call this an intrinsic pathway because what starts this pathway is just something that's inherent within the blood itself. Right, we call this the extrinsic pathway because where does thromboplastin come from? Not from the blood, but from the tissues that are outside of blood that are damaged. And since it's coming from the outside, we call this the extrinsic pathway. The intrinsic pathway can happen all by itself. It's just a natural property of blood. All right, so blood just has this natural process. All right, even for this intrinsic pathway, what do you need? You need calcium and phospholipids. That's a similarity with the extrinsic pathway. All right, so you have activated factor 9, which can also then activate prothrombin activator, which then starts this common pathway to fibrin formation. Now, here are some of the little complicating features. All right, thrombin can help activate factor 11. All right, and if we produce more factor 11, that produces more what? More thrombin. And when you produce more thrombin, that produces more factor 11, which produces more thrombin. Is that a positive feedback or a negative feedback? That's a positive feedback mechanism which speeds up coagulation. And this is a necessary step for proper coagulation to take place in normal individuals. All right, so even though this extrinsic pathway is normally how coagulation starts, for normal clotting function, you still need a proper intrinsic pathway or you will be a bleeder. All right, so you got that positive feedback mechanism. All right, then we talked about anticoagulants like heparin. Heparin blocks the action of thrombin on activating factor 11 that disturbs this positive feedback mechanism, which then decreases clotting function, so that can be used as an anticoagulant. Let's see, coumarin. What did we say coumarin did? I think it affects prothrombin formation, right, which then, of course, is going to inhibit fibrin formation. And vitamin K. If you don't have proper vitamin K in your diet, I think vitamin K is necessary for the liver to produce numerous clotting factors right here, as well as I think it helps regulate calcium release into the blood. And we talked about vitamin K, where you get that from, right? Green leafy vegetables, for instance. So that's what I want you to know about coagulation with maybe this other little caveat. So a lot of times when you're on anticoagulation therapy, what's a common way that lay people talk about it? Even if you go to a clinic and you'll talk to a doctor, they'll say, heparin is not something that decreases clotting function, or an anticoagulant is what? A blood thinner. Okay? And if you have a solution and you make it thicker, what happens to it? It becomes more viscous. It's thicker. It's harder to flow from one place to the other. So that's the concept that, or the analogy that people like to use, right? But when you take coumarin or heparin, does it actually thin your blood? Does it make your blood any thinner? No, because coagulation is this very active process right here. It has nothing to do with the viscosity of your blood, right? So it doesn't matter if your blood is thin or thick. Right? It all depends on the nature of clotting factors and whether you have fibrinogen, right? Or whether or not you have prothrombin, right? So it's an active process. It's not something that's just passively engineered into the viscosity of your blood. So when people say blood thinners, you should just kind of, what, chuckle very politely and not just laugh in somebody's face. But of course, you could laugh in somebody's face and And that would be okay with me, all right? Because it's not thinning somebody's blood at all. All right, so how's that? Does that help you see that a little bit better, maybe? Okay, okay. All right. All right, the other thing you should be aware of is the difference between coagulation and agglutination. Are they different? Absolutely. Okay. Does either one of those have to do with thinning of the blood? No, absolutely not. Okay. How would you talk about agglutination? It's an antigen-antibody reaction, right? And you should know something about antigens, where they're found, antibodies, where they're found, what they look like, what's the relationship between them. Okay. But basically, they're going to glom onto each other if they have what? The proper shape, right? So structure always determines what the function is going to be. And if the structure changes, then of course the function changes radically. All right, I want to do just a couple of definitions. Cardiac output. Cardiac output is the volume of blood that's pumped by the heart or from one ventricle every minute. And what can you tell me about cardiac output between the right ventricle and left ventricle? Okay, let's just say over a period of time of maybe about a minute. Not instantaneously, but maybe over, you know, a minute, 60 seconds or so. What should be the cardiac output of the right ventricle compared to the left ventricle? They should be exactly the same, right? They should match up. Because if the amount of blood that's pumped by the left ventricle is greater than the right, then blood is going to back up someplace, right? It's got to flow around in a nice circle, right? So to understand cardiac output, we can look at a couple things. The first thing is stroke volume. And we defined stroke volume already. That's just the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart every time it beats. And how would you calculate stroke volume? From some volumes of the heart. What volume of the heart is the biggest? Is it end diastolic or end systolic volume? The end diastolic volume is big. And if we subtract out the end systolic volume, right, so this is big, that's small, guess what we get? We get the stroke volume. And when we measure a volume of something, what units of measure do we use? At least in science, what's the measure that we use? You can use cc's, what's another name for cc? Cubic centimeter, that's a milliliter, right? Or you could say milliliter. So stroke volume is in milliliters. That's the stroke volume of the heart, and you could calculate it. Oh, make sure you know how to calculate that. I think I have that on one of your questions, right? Because I might give you a figure or a word question, something like that. Okay, but what is cardiac output? Cardiac output, right here, is the amount of blood that's flowing out of the heart every time it beats. So that is the amount of blood. How do we measure the amount of blood? That's milliliters per what period of time? Okay. Milliliters, and we're going to say minutes. So that is a volume per time. Volume per time is what we call flow. That's the amount of blood. Volume per time is flow. As opposed to what is velocity? Velocity is what you see on your speedometer. What do you see on your speedometer? Speed. What is speed? Distance. Per what? Per time. All right. Oh, so what is this? This is volume per time. So you see that there is this inherent difference between velocity and flow, right? So, I have flow down over here, okay? So flow is volume per time, velocity is just distance per time. Two different kinds of considerations. And when we're considering the heart, do we want to just know how fast the blood is flowing? Not necessarily. We want to know how much is flowing, what the volume per time is. And that's cardiac output. All right, so we got stroke volume. What's that? That's volume. Could we use that to measure, to help measure cardiac output? Absolutely, right? Because what do we need? We need a volume, and we got a volume right here. What else do we need to measure cardiac output? Well, on the slide right there, I've got, sorry about this, it's not very linear on the board. Cardiac output is going to be, oh, I have it over here, volume per time. Okay, cardiac output is stroke volume, milliliters, oh, let me put this right here like that, milliliters per, what kind of time unit is there right here? Oh, I got to stop. Per beat. Milliliter per beat. Every time the heart beats. Okay? That's stroke volume. So cardiac output, milliliters per beat. And how can you measure, what's a measure of heart rate? Beats per minute. So we got beats per minute right here. All right, so if we got these two units, what do we have left over? The beats cancels out, and we have milliliters per minute. That's the units for cardiac output. All right, so in other words, what do we need to measure cardiac output? We've got to have stroke volume times heart rate. And that's just a really nice, simple algebraic equation. If we know two of those variables, we can calculate the third very easily. Okay. All right, sorry about going a little bit long right there. I'll start there next time.